From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Author, sociologist, and journalist Todd Gitlin, who lived and taught for years here in the Bay Area, is now professor at Columbia University, and has co-authored a new book called Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeal of Divine Election, which argues that both the United States and Israel have been guided and burdened by the notion of being chosen. Todd Gitlin joins us in studio for the hour ahead with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Todd Gitlin, once a radical SDS leader in the 60s and the author of the best-selling The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, is now a social commentator and media analyst and also a professor of journalism and sociology and chairs the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. His 12th book is co-authored with Leah Leibovitz. And let me tell you something about Leah Leibovitz, his co-author. He's a former non-commissioned officer in the Israeli Defense Forces and is the author of Aliyah, Three Generations of American Jewish Immigration to Israel, and co-author of Lily Marlene, The Soldier's Song of World War II, and professor of communications at New York University and editor at Tablet, which is an online magazine of Jewish life. They have put together a book that is all about divine election and exceptionalism. Well, what is that? Well, in their words, it's what both Israel and the United States have in common, and maybe, in fact, behind the close relationship, the close alliance between the United States and Israel. They have been guided, these two countries, and burdened and haunted, in their words, two democratic nations, by the idea of being chosen. The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election is their book, and they join us in studio this hour. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be here.
Hello.
Good to have you back, Todd, and good to meet you, Liel. Let's begin talk about the genesis of this book, but let me go to someplace else first.
Let's talk about the Exodus.
It's sort of, I suppose, obvious to many people that these two countries believe in the idea that they were chosen by God and chosen by God to carry out, as you point out in your book, a redemptive mission, but maybe not so obvious that this has, I'll use the Damasio word here, been in the center of the consciousness, or the national consciousness of these two countries, and remains there.
It's sometimes in the center of the unconsciousness, but it's always rumbling under the surface, the sense of the special mission, the idea that it's not just a nation, it's a cause. America famously is defined ideologically, not ethnically. Anybody can become an American. And the Jews also were defined by an idea that they had been specially anointed. And this is quite unusual. It's not unusual for countries to flirt with this at some point or other in their history, but usually they get over it or they have it knocked out of them, usually by defeat. And so what's unusual, I mean, the Japanese have had it, the Germans have had it, the French.
A lot Russians. Of countries still have it. I think Saudi Arabia would be a pretty good example, or Poland, which calls itself the Nation of Christ, or, one can go on and on, but not with empires, I mean, or not with that sense of manifest destiny or territory being part of the whole vision, really.
Indeed.
And not to that extent, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, you go back to the origins of this republic and you see this idea of the New Israel. So much of this is based in New Testament, really, isn't it?
Well, actually, Old Testament.
I mean, Old Testament, excuse me. Yeah. It's a New Testament.
God's New Israel was a phrase used before the English settlers ever got here. It was a sort of MapQuest or Google Map version of what we were going to find here. God's New Israel.
Yeah, they didn't take it lightly. This is not a metaphor for them. There were actually calculations, trying to decide where precisely would, the new Zion, the new Jerusalem fall, and all these arguments that it had to be in the West, and therefore this is where we need to go.
There was even a dispute between English and Spanish settlers as to whether the new Jerusalem would be Spanish or English speaking.
Well, a lot of the Spanish thought it was going to be El Dorado, I guess, didn't they? But in a sense, it was a utopian ideal. It was a city upon the hill and all of that. It would be God's heaven here on earth, really.
City upon a hill is one of the distorted phrases, I guess, early versions of the sort of thing that's thrown at Obama now, in that people repeat the line of City upon a hill. Reagan gilded it famously with Shining. But they don't repeat the next phrase, which has to do with that all the world may see and see us as an example, in other words.
A light unto nations.
Exactly, a light unto the nations.
And that all the world may see and that all the world may judge. I mean, it's sort of the great burden.
You better make this good. Or as the Declaration of Independence put it, you know, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind.
But I always had the notion somehow, Liel, that chosenness in the real historical sense of the ancient people, the Jews, had to do with their being the people who were chosen to have the Torah.
Well, for Jews, it's a very complicated concept. I mean, the story, as we're told, is downright bizarre. It begins when God selects one man, Abraham, then called Abram, who the Torah says absolutely nothing about, is completely undistinguished in every way, and tells that man, you know, leave your father's house and go to this country. And here we are about 400 or 500 years later. The descendants of this particular man congregate in the foothills of Mount Sinai, and God appears at what is sort of the pinnacle of the story and says, "You will be unto me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation." And then God sort of recedes into the cloud and leaves absolutely no instruction as for what this really means. Chosen why? Chosen for what? What are we doing? Can we be unchosen?
Well, he receded into the cloud until he appeared in the bush, and that was, or appeared on Sinai and gave down the tablets, which was part of the choice, I guess, wasn't it?
Well, sure, but the idea of chosen, I mean, Tanai say in the book, and only part in jest, that to have been chosen, it's such a strange thing. To have been chosen means, in part, to spend a lifetime wondering what it means to have been chosen. It sort of drives you to madness and into this endless stream of interpretation. And what we suggest in the book is that there are really, at the very least, two different strands of interpretation to this idea of chosenness. The one is the more, if you will, materialistic, simplistic, straightforward, that says, well, chosenness means we're tops, we're the select people, we're the people, you know, who God pointed out, and therefore we have the right to the specific land, and we have the right to sort of powerfully remove anyone else who may contest our claims.
We are the elect.
We are the elect, and we have sort of, you know, a divine license to kill. The other interpretation, which is equally as deeply ingrained into the text and into Jewish tradition and thought, says that chosenness is not a divine mandate, but a terrible burden. It means, just like the city on a hill, that the eyes of the world are upon us, and therefore we need to set an example, and therefore we have a commitment to progressive values, a commitment to compassion, a commitment to justice, which is incredibly hard to live up to and comes at a great price. And I think both are present right there at the moment of chosenness.
The latter is a kind of messianism, isn't it, in many respects? I mean,
each of them can be messianic.
Yeah.
Because both of them impose sort of basically to be a Jew is something not to relax into in neither case. It's something to get on about doing. It's work.
This is a statement from Hanukkah, by the way. To be a Jew, not relaxing.
Well, that's why Hanukkah was invented, to take the edge off.
Let's go back to the American sense of chosenness, though, because I was struck by, and there it is again in your book, Abraham Lincoln's words, America's are God's almost chosen people.
Yeah.
I mean, Lincoln made that important qualification, didn't
Well,
he?
It's interestingly enough the only time he ever used the phrase. He represents one side of the tradition, which in a sense runs parallel to the Jewish idea that the Jews are the people who choose. Lincoln is saying that the work of being chosen is something that the difference has to be made up by what the Americans do. This is not a party favor that was given to you people because you have a lot of land and a lot of minerals because you know, you're nifty.
Would Lincoln have used that word, nifty?
he would have used the biblical word. Lincoln, who was deeply steeped in the Bible, it was really his school, knew very well that he was toying with the conventional kind of slick, streamlined version, and that he was on his way to putting out something really quite demanding. He used this phrase, by the way, as he was on his way to his first inauguration. So it's a sort of – it's a get ready – people, we have a lot of work to do. The more typical version of chosenness in the 19th century was the idea of manifest destiny, was the idea that of clearing the land, moving the natives away because they confounded the project.
Well, they were the unchosen, I guess.
They were the unchosen. The unchosen really – I mean, that's the problem with chosenness is that as soon as we start talking chosenness, people who are not among the chosen start saying, hey, what about us?
And in fact, you can look at the history of both Israel and the United States in terms of, well, what we're calling the unchosen here and those who were selected as the unchosen, unfortunately. Although you, I think both of you began this book thinking that the idea of chosenness was a scourge, but you also came to the realization that there have been many accomplishments and an extraordinary kind of dynamo as a result of this.
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, we started off this project sort of wishing to write the book that would lay this wild and dangerous idea to rest. But I think the more we read and the more we learned about the histories and theologies of both nations, we understood that this idea is inevitable. It is there. It is wild. It is sort of thumping in the hearts and the minds of both countries. And as we write in the end of the introduction, we have no choice but to wrestle with it because behind our backs, it's wrestling with us.
It even wrestles with, in Israel, some of the more secular Jews who, with the settlements, may be opposed, but yet at the same time not opposed enough because somewhere maybe in their collective history DNA or in their memory is that sense of chosenness.
Well, it's striking. I mean, since the book came out, actually, I was in Israel for a conference about 5 weeks ago, and I heard a speech by Ehud Barak, quite secular, Labor Party, maybe he's not just the leader of the Labor Party, he is the Labor Party at this point. And he used the phrase heavenly promise to refer to Israel. I thought that the fact that he did it with such ease.
You think he was playing to the right in the Knesset or something? It could have been political.
I'm sure that was an aspect of it. But I think also it's, you know, that the streets speak that language. This is not a language that's exclusive to the zealots. And I think the effort to deny it, which is actually given in the history of Zionism, which originally was a quite irreligious or anti-religious movement, the attempt to deny it is in a sense a proof of its tenacity.
And we see it. I mean, we see it even in the words and the thoughts of the men and women we think of as a sort of highly secular founders of both the Zionist movement and Israel. I mean, we repeat in this book this amazing scene from Herzl, who's the sort of founding father of Zionism.
Theodor Herzl.
In which this is, by the way, interestingly enough, he never repeated this anecdote in his lifetime. He told it to his biographer with a stipulation it'd only appear after his death. And it's something like this. He says, I had this recurrent dream influenced by his grandfather, who was a rabbi. And in the dream, I was whisked off to heaven, where angels took me to meet Gabriel, the archangel, and Gabriel looks
She's
at
sounding
me and
uncomfortably
says,
like Muhammad in a way, doesn't it?
Get this. And Gabriel says, oh, you're the one for whom the Jewish people have been waiting all these millennia. It's a striking, messianic, amazing vision that moved the man. I mean, when Chaim Weizmann, who eventually became Israel's first president, received the word of the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government supported a state for the Jews in Israel.
A homeland,
right, for Jews in Israel. His exact words were, I laughed, I cried, I heard the footfalls of Messiah. This is from someone who is a scientist, is a highly secular person. I mean, we see it again and again in Ben-Gurion. We see it in Rabin. We see it in all of the founding fathers of Zionism. And it's still very prevalent.
Well, I have to throw out a little favorite thesis of my own is that because the Messiah didn't come for the Jewish people, there were surrogate messiahs. One of them was Zionism. Another one was feminism. Another one was socialism. I mean, you know, it sounds very reductive and simple. But in many ways, for those who were not motivated toward the religious and who are becoming more secular, those things tended to be surrogates.
Well, Jews think big.
Jews do, but there's also an interesting concept of what exactly is the Jewish idea of the Messiah. I mean, the Jewish idea of the Messiah is so wonderfully twisted and bizarre. It's not the Christian idea in which, you know, the Son of God comes and redeems us all, and through faith in him, we too are redeemed. The idea is that the Messiah will only come once we're all ready for him. And we're only ready for him once we're all just and compassionate and follow the spirit, if not the letter, of the laws of Torah. And if we all do that, and if we're all ready for Messiah, you know, guess who we don't need anymore? You know, the Messiah, because we have redeemed ourselves.
It's all there in Isaiah, isn't it? And all the map of it laid out.
Certainly.
But when you talk about redemption for Christians, this has a lot to do with this special alliance or relationship, whatever you want to call it, bond between the United States and Israel. I mean, in many ways, ostensibly, many people assume it's because both democracies and so forth, both believing in democratic principles. There's more to do, I think, as you intimate and point out explicitly in your book, with this so-called special relationship, with the idea that both countries see themselves as chosen.
We look at each other and recognize each other. When religious fundamentalists from the United States go to a religious settlement on the West Bank, they feel at home. And in a way, our book is aiming to explain why that is. They feel that mutually that they have been singled out for not just special treatment, but for parallel histories. You know, we know what it's like to live in a dangerous neighborhood. We know what it's like to feel embattled. We also know what it's like to, you know, to strive to turn the sense of embattlement into a sense of grace, which very easily grows into a sense of that you can walk on water. And that you are impeccable, and this is the dangerous side of the idea that we've been twinned, singled out for this monumental distinction, which of course gets other people who haven't been so singled out rather annoyed.
But getting back to what Liel said a moment ago, though, there's also that sense that the new age, the messianic age, will be ushered in somehow. I mean, whether it's the rapture in Christianity because of what's going on in Israel, today's Israel, fulfilling the prophecies and so forth, or whether it's what the Jews believe in, which, I mean, I'm talking about maybe more the zealous and Orthodox Jews, which is a messianic age coming in when, as you suggested, the Jews have proven themselves worthy.
Well, as Lincoln would have said, as did say, almost chosen. That is to say, you know, get good. The challenge is to you.
Well, this whole book is a challenge in many ways. That is, how to live with how these new nations can really not necessarily overcome, but make sense out of this in a way that is not not sowing the kind of seeds that have been sown in the past. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah, to find the moral equivalent of imperialism. to paraphrase what William James said about the need to find a moral equivalent of war. That is to say, to find a sense of purpose which is ethical, which is a gift, but which is not a brag, nor is it an imposition. And that's a delicate business. That is the problem of both Americans and Israelis at this very moment.
And I think the more we sort of looked into it, the more we realized that actually the position that this book takes, or the position this book argues, is, or maybe at the very least, the sort of a great big missing position in both American and Israeli politics, which is to say, the position of the if I may, religious left, which says, there is a lot there in our histories and our theologies that we don't need to discard or downplay, but from which we could derive a lot of strength to sort of engine a powerful movement.
So to do that, though, one has to overcome the kind of hubris that's connected to this notion of chosenness.
Well, let me give an example.
I mean, it becomes like a Greek tragedy almost when you think about it in those terms.
It's mighty Greek. Let me give an example from American history that strikes me as very much in the Lincoln tradition. There is a tradition among African Americans going back to the 19th century that not only are they charged with freeing themselves, but they're actually charged with freeing America. They identify with the passage in Isaiah about the suffering servant, that you're redeeming the sins of all. And if this sounds vaguely familiar to people of our vintage, it's because that line of argument was picked up again by Martin Luther King. who thought that the civil rights movement was not simply a movement to free black people, but it was a movement to free Americans from this awful institution which had been so formative here.
You mean slavery or racism or
– Well, both, yeah. Slavery and yeah, the whole complex. King, was speaking the language of chosenness. It was sort of doubled there. It was the African Americans chosen to be the redeemers of America, which had a mission in the world. This kind of language was not alien to what we think of as the values of the left at all.
Of course, both nations are nations built on refugees, and seeing themselves not only as chosen but as battling pioneers had a lot to do with forming the national character. And there are these parallels that continue. One has to ask, to what extent can, well, say, the countercultures really affect, if you look at, say, the black American experience as being a kind of counterculture, as you're suggesting, can they get into the major form of the bloodstream? I mean, in Israel today, you've got how many citizens who are of Arab descent living in Israel, for example?
About 20%.
About 25%,
something like that.
I mean, how much is that a countervailing influence, or can be like what Todd is saying about African Americans in terms of the American self?
Well, it would be a great step forward if Israeli opinion recognized the stranger in their midst not as a nuisance or as a rival, but as a partner in building a society that deserves the name Jewish.
And the possibility for that is right there. I mean, if you look at sort of the Israeli body politic for the last, 15 years, you see what can only appear as sort of great confusion. I mean, we've had a very successful stream of parties sort of rise in strength to become the third largest party in Israel, only to disappear the very next election cycle. I mean, the very last example of it is the Retired People's Party, which is, one of my favorite examples, because if you're retired and then you get a job as a member of Knesset, aren't you by definition no longer retired? But these parties come and go, and I think the massive support that they receive from Israeli electorate time and again, the massive support that figures like Avigdor Lieberman, the extreme right-wing foreign minister, enjoy currently, has to do, I think, less with some sort of real ideological turn and more with some sort of confusion that somehow the traditional values of Zionism on which, we have all been raised are seemingly defunct, are seemingly no longer needed, are seemingly very problematic, and everything sort of drowns under this wave of politics. I think if the majority of Israelis could, in a sense, eat their cake and have it too, if they could understand that they do not have to give up this tradition that says that they are indeed in some way exceptional, this tradition that says that it is in their historical and religious heritage to see themselves as a quote-unquote light unto the nations, they could do a whole lot politically.
Well, we are coming up on a break, and that affords us the opportunity to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. You are certainly welcome to do that. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Join us at 866-733-6786. Your questions and comments welcome. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment talking with Professors Todd Gitlin and Leah Leibovitz about their book, Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeal of Divine Election. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about chosenness, about what it means to be burdened, guided, and haunted by a sense of divine election or exceptionalism. Chosenness, both Todd Gitlin and Leah Leibovitz in their book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, talk about in conjunction with those two nations. Let's bring your calls in, and let's begin with a caller from Sacramento. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this subject. It's a juicy topic. I think probably going to be a controversial one, like so many that you have. I'm concerned about the concept of divine election and how it's represented itself both in Israel and in the United States. especially in the United States, being an American. I'm not sure that it's been good for either of us. I think with Israel having a longer history, there are more examples of how this concept of divine election has hurt that people. Most notable, or one that comes to mind easily, the Zealots and their stand against Rome. And I'm worried about our country going down that same path and identifying too readily with Israel and with that concept.
Well, that same anxiety comes across in your work, I think.
Well, we are deeply anxious about
Absolutely.
That potential. And I mean, I wouldn't want to discourage that anxiety. I feel it every day. I live with it. I just don't think it can be repealed. After all, what are the Jews? The Jews are built on a belief that at least a tolerance for the belief that they have a distinct mission. So you can't simply toss it off, I believe. Without sort of basically committing, moral suicide. So I think so that's the practical reason to hold to it. The second is that there actually are treasures buried within it, and there's an aspect of the tradition that's actually highly usable. Which is basically it says, I think the proper understanding of chosenness for Israelis is you're not called upon to be a normally piggish, thuggish, throw your weight around, hard-bitten country, you actually have a standard to live up to. So it seems to me that's an ambition that should not be tossed aside.
Do you remember Sal Bellow's book, Jerusalem and Back, where he said Israel mm-hmm. is the moral Switzerland of the world, like a moral vacation place? the idea being that the United States looks at Israel as this fellow light unto nations, but most other countries in the world obviously do not.
No, I mean, it's a pariah nation. And, Israel is not the worst country in the world. I mean, that's an absurdity. On the other hand, it lives with the abominations of occupation in a way that I think actually defy the charge, the heart of Jewish tradition. And I'd like to see those who are abusing the Jewish tradition in the name of such harsh values challenged on their own ground. I think you can't just stand outside clamoring and expect them to give up Jewishness. I think that what they are doing is undermining the Jewish tradition.
I completely agree. We write in the book, if Israel wants to be a Jewish state, let it be a Jewish state. I think part of the reason why Israel is singled out for such calumny right now, internationally, some of it deserved, much of it not, has to do with the fact, when a nation is sort of built on the principle of exceptionalism and of having been elected for some obscure reason by God, it should expect that kind of special attention. And it should resume its mission immediately or face grave consequences.
But it was also built on the ashes of the Holocaust. And I think that has to be pretty quickly put into this whole equation, which is simply to say that there's always that memory of the world being against the Jews and
Correct,
trying
but,
to just, do away with them.
Correct. But we argue this is only to an extent. One of the things that fascinates us the most about Zionism, if I may go off on a little bit of a tangent here, is why does it still exist? You ask Italians today about 160 years after Garibaldi, no one would identify themselves as a Garibaldist. And yet a majority of Jews in Israel, and I think plurality of American Jews as well, would define themselves as Zionists. And we argue that Zionism isn't merely the sort of movement to build a national homeland for Jews in Israel. Rather, it is a sort of a continuation by other means of the same spirit or same messianic spirit of yearning to once again return to the promised land and work again at trying to be that kingdom of priests and holy nation that the Bible entrusts us with being.
Albeit the fact that national identity is often retro in that sense. You hear South American nations now bringing up Simón Bolívar and
sure.
So it goes. But let me go to more calls here and we'll bring a caller in named Carla. Hi.
Hi. I'm not a biblical historian, but I wanted to present the Christian point of view because I think there are some assumptions that the guests are making about that this country was founded by Christians, not by Jews. I think you're making some assumptions about how the Christians see this whole idea of the anointing. I wanted to just read something from Isaiah, and you'll find it familiar because it's in the in Handel's work, The Messiah, and it says, to whom is the arm of God revealed? And I'll have to jump. For he shall grow up before him a tender plant. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. We hid our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs. He was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with him, with his stripes, we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one into his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. This is the foundation of what the Christians believe, why the Christians believe Christ was the Messiah. And Paul, who was a Jew, said that the Jews missed, they actually lost their anointing because they missed the point of what their job was to be, which was to be a light unto the world and bring a message of love. The Arabs are their half-brothers. And the message that they bring today is the message of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, who were the kind of the legalists, the lawyers of that day, and not the Essenes, which was the group that Jesus was associated with. So I want to gently and with tenderness and brotherly love challenge what you're saying, because what I see going on in the Middle East is two mirrors. Like, I think the Jews and the Arabs act a lot alike. They think each other should be wiped out and the other should rule the world. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees were looking for a Messiah to help them rule the world. And that's why they rejected Jesus' message, because it wasn't one of power. It was one of love and accept your brother and all this stuff. And that wasn't politically, well, expedient for them in terms of gaining power.
All right, I'm going to get some response here.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. I don't disagree with you. I fervently agree with you. Not in your endorsement of the Christian idea about who Jesus was, but this is exactly the passage from Isaiah that I referred to before in the African American tradition, the idea of the suffering servant. I don't think it's quite that bitter in the Middle East, there's a bit of hyperbole in one thing you said, but I certainly agree that that Jesus, who was a Jew, was furthering a strand within the Jewish tradition that speaks exactly the language you're speaking of. And so I don't see any conflict at all with the tenor of your remarks. And,
so thank you for the remarks. Yeah,
and,
go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that strand, by the way, or that struggle between the harshness of the law and the tenderness of love is still a struggle that very much goes on within, you know, Jewish thought today. It's a struggle that you know, we have never abandoned. And throughout this book, intertwined with the idea of chosenness are the ideas of compassion, of justice, of peace, which very much, you know, resonates still in Jewish tradition.
Well, you mentioned Abraham before. Part of the ongoing problem, I think, between Jews and Arabs is the fact that go back to Isaac and Ishmael, but even in addition to that, we're both colonized people. And so, to some extent, they have taken out a lot of their experience on each other just by fact of being colonized by Europeans.
Well,
I mean, it's more than the religious, I think, that has to be factored.
No, there's a social psychology of, you know, both, you know, the promise of liberation and the experience of embattlement that the national history is a history of triumph over adversity. Now, that's true of nations in general, but there's this special religious edge, I think, that makes us feel intimately related with Israel in the way that we don't, let's say, with other democracies like India and South Korea.
Some listeners write, here's Lee, who writes, granted that Israel and the United States share a sense of divinely ordained manifest destiny, though I'd guess that only around half of each country really feels this way. But it seems odd that your guests don't mention the fact that the Ummah also shares a sense of divinely ordained manifest destiny, at least as much as America and Israel. And unlike the U.S. and Israel, the Islamic sense of manifest destiny has led to the ethnic cleansing of most non-Muslims from most Arab countries, starting with some 800,000 Jews in 1948, right up to the extirpation of Iraq's million-odd Christians that's going on today.
Well, we actually discuss the Islamic idea of chosenness very vividly in the book. We haven't gotten to it.
It's a caliphate that's going to exist in the future, right?
No, they're within all the varieties of chosenness is a propensity toward exclusivity and, if you will, ethnic cleansing. And this is part of what's so volatile and dangerous about the idea of chosenness. So I don't disagree with the point at all.
Ken says, this is a fascinating interview, but I can't help but question a basic premise of the book. I'm 63 years old. I've lived in the United States my entire life. I've never heard anyone say or imply that Americans are the chosen peoples of God. This includes my grandparents' generation, my parents' generation, my college professors, etc. I don't doubt that the Puritans had this deep sense of connection to Old Testament prophecy, but my question is, how many Americans really believe this today? Well, one out of seven Americans is evangelical. Let's begin there.
Well, let's also, wasn't there a fellow named George W. Bush around not too long ago?
Angel of rides directing the storm.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And Reagan with the rapture and Jimmy Carter with a lot of the born-again philosophy. Mm-hmm. They didn't quite put it necessarily in this.
And even in a sense, you know, if we may, Obama, I mean, we see a very strong kind of like Lincolnian moment in his inaugural speech in which he says, you know, we have to choose our better history. Which we think is completely an echo to the idea of, hey, we're almost chosen. We need to work to prove that this is correct. We need to appeal to those angels of our nature, which are indeed better.
By the way, even the founding fathers who were famously, if not irreligious, they were Enlightenment intellectuals, had no discomfort with this language. Jefferson, who was quite explicitly anti-Christian, used
deist,
the term.
Really, yeah.
And Franklin and Adams. I mean, one of the little-known facts we came upon researching American history was that on July 4th, 1776, in addition to getting a bunch of signatures on a document in Philadelphia, the Continental Congress appointed a committee to draw up a national seal, a design for a national seal. It was a committee made up of Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. And these guys went off and came up with three models, and each of them featured biblical designs.
I thought it was Chaim Solomon who actually made up the seal.
Well, that's later.
Jefferson had the figure of Moses standing with his rod pointing heavenwards. And the seed, the part, I mean, a very classic Exodus image. I think Adams, who is the most religious of the three, actually chose Hercules as a sort of model.
What's interesting is, you know, we're all in recoil, I think properly so, against the idea that this is a Christian republic. But I think the scholarship of the last 20 years, which was new to me when I turned to it, is quite clear about the power of the Great Awakenings of both the 17th and the 18th century, which were, you know, so that in a sense the American Revolution, I think, should be understood as a movement of evangelical Christians led by Enlightenment intellectuals.
Here's a listener who says, I feel the need to hear more critique of the concept of chosen, the genocide of the Native Americans, inhuman treatment to the Palestinians. Is this the ordeal?
It is an ordeal. And a good deal of our book is about these two stories. You know, we're not here all day and night. I'll be happy to read the book to you personally if you'll buy it.
Hassan writes, please ask your guest to comment on my comment below. The notion that Jewish exceptionalism and chosenness are similar to American manifest destiny is overblown by your guest to hide major differences. The United States has a constitution and basic laws guaranteeing equality for all. Israel has no constitution, and its laws privilege Jewish citizens, discriminate against non-Jewish citizens in every aspect, including family reunification, right of return, land ownership, marriage laws, subsidy for education and community services, etc. In the United States, racism is a violation of the country's value. In Israel, a Jewish state, racism against non-Jews is the state value.
While I'm not sure I would put it exactly like this, Hassan, I think you make a very valid point. There are indeed deeply ingrained differences between both countries. First and foremost, you know, unfortunately, being that Israel does not have a constitution, and as a result of which a bunch of fairly noxious laws have been able to pass without resistance. However, I think that both nations are still guided or are still struggling with pretty much the same idea, at the one end of which lies, if we may, you know, redemption, and at the other end, a deep, deep, dark, troubled waters.
Another listener who signs Sarah, who signs her email Chag Sameach, says this topic, of course, is super sensitive for Jews and non-Jews alike. In fact, it more than anything makes me nervous about being Jewish and loving being Jewish. One of the things that I learned that made it finally make sense for me was that we were chosen for was to be the ones to follow halakha, that is Jewish law, and the 613 commandments. If we're chosen for this, that's fine, but to be chosen for some role, it's very hard to carry that. I've had to defend this issue to so many who use it to condemn Jews. Ugh. It makes you just want to stay within the Jewish community so you can stop worrying about it.
Well, so, Sarah, first of all, since this is the first night of Hanukkah, Chag Sameach, happy holiday to you, too. I identify, you know, extremely with what you just said. I grew up, you know, sort of the scion of this great big rabbinical family, and I really couldn't handle this idea of divine election. It was the one thing that personally kept me away from the whole notion of you know, feeling truly Jewish, because I felt it was absurd to claim that one group of people was somehow, you know, elevated among the rest. But as a result, by the way, we started off this book kind of trying to put down this notion. But the more I learned about it, the more I learned that this idea of uncertainty, this idea of trying to figure out what it means, this idea that always keeps you on guard and always keeps you questioning, you know, what's the right thing to do, is actually a great big moral vehicle. And I think when posed like this has incredible potential to do good.
We also had Antonio Damasio with us last hour, one of the most formidable neuroscientists in the world, and a listener asked, you know, can you, if you have positive attitudes in effect, can it make for more positive outcomes? And his answer was absolutely. So here is this notion of chosenness, which in a sense gives people cognitively a better sense of their future, a better sense maybe of what they can accomplish. I mean, this is almost like positive
cognitively
thinking,
and spiritually, I mean, more importantly.
I don't myself feel chosen by God. I'm agnostic. I do feel I have a calling, but it's not from on high, I don't even know where it is. It's somewhere. It's touched me. I would never try to persuade somebody that they should follow 613 laws, or that they should embrace an idea that for good and sufficient reason is alien. Analytically, what we're trying to do in the book is to get both Jews and Americans, or those who are both, to take seriously the idea that this is a guiding light of their traditions. Whether you like it or not, it's there.
One quick anecdote, if I may, about this whole idea of laws. We grapple with it in the book. Let me tell you a very quick anecdote. So there's a point in which Moses, having struggled and you know, if we may, killed quite a few people to maintain some sort of hierarchy in this errant camp of Israelites sort of slogging its way through the desert, says, okay, well, you know, I'm going to select 70 elders, and they're going to come to a distinct part of our camp, and there God will reveal his prophecy to them. And here, the elders go away, and two young people named Eldad and Medad all of a sudden start, you know, speaking in tongues and sort of seeing these great big visions of God. And Joshua, who is at that point Moses' second in command, you know, comes to the master and says, you know, you have to kill these two because you said, you know, only the 70s. We have to be very strict about, you know, the hierarchy. And here are these two prophesying. That's against the law. And Moses looks at the young Joshua and says, you don't get it. You know, these people are touched by the Spirit of God. It is the Spirit rather than the letter that I care more about. And I think a Jewish tradition, although it certainly has a lot to do with keeping halacha, keeping the commandments, it also has a lot to do with following the Spirit.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much into hermeneutics here, but I'm also reminded as you tell that anecdote of the story in the Bible when the Egyptians were being drowned in the Red Sea, and God said, why are you cheering? These are my people too, mm-hmm. You know, I created them as well.
Yeah.
Let me get another caller on. That's Nancy. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I think it's, excuse me, very interesting that both in Israel and in this country, when, you know, the people arrive, we displace the people that were here, seeming that, you know, we had the only right to be here or there. And the other thing is the idea that the Jews have the right to be in the land that they are because of the Bible, to me, is just really foolish. I mean, this is a book that is basically, you know, a bunch of tales and has really nothing to do with really anything except the religion. And I mean, I don't say, I'm Jewish, and I don't say that the Jews didn't have a right to a homeland, but the idea that they have a divine right to where they are, to me, is just ridiculous. And the idea that, you know, American exceptionalism has brought us, not only for us grief, but grief to all the other peoples that we have tried to conquer. And anyways, that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. We thank you for saying it. And we'll go right to another caller, and that's Colin. Good morning.
Good morning. Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli foreign minister, has called for non-Jewish citizens of Israel who do not declare a loyalty oath to Israel to be stripped of their citizenship. This really doesn't square with American values. How would American Jews feel if they were required to sign or swear a oath of loyalty to the U.S. as a Christian government? And secondly, if Israel has, you know, a divine grace, as it were, a chosen status, then they don't really need the $3 billion in aid that the U.S. taxpayer provides, as well as the veto at the U.N. Security Council, do they?
Well, I'll start by telling, you know, a very quick joke. You know, there used to be this guy who went to the Wailing Wall every day and prayed to God to help him win the lottery every day for weeks, for months, for years. Finally, one of the angels, you know, comes to him and says, "Well, you know, this poor schmuck has been praying to win the lottery every day. Why wouldn't you help him?" And God said, "Well, you know, I would, but he never fills out a ticket." Which is to say, you know, even righteous nations sometimes need some help. But let me get to the, I think, more prevalent point that you were making about Avigdor Lieberman. Look, you're absolutely right. This is this loyalty oath business is a terrible, dark and racist bit of legislation, which I think is deeply troubling and should deeply trouble not only American Jews, but also Americans who support Israel by virtue of being taxpayers. And I think it's much more of a sign of urgency that we need, as is, you know, that Israelis need and Americans need to help Israel in that sense, really get back on track and abandon this sort of single-minded madness that seems to have grasped the country in recent years.
I would just add, in the name of Americanism, we have our equivalent madmen, you know, people, you know, let's invade Arab countries and kill all the leaders. We can't permit an Islamic center near Ground Zero. I mean, this is all dangerous stuff, and this is a dangerous ideology, and that's why we're trying to tame it and turn it to constructive use rather than surrender to the most barbaric constructions of it.
Well, we're getting some emailers who are expressing some criticism, and I want to get these on the record. This is Earl, who says, in discussing the concept of the divine election of Israel, one of your guests said that one way of looking at this was to see it as a carte blanche to commit genocide. This displays an astonishing and unforgivable ignorance. The commandment to extirpate the Canaanites was because of the depraved immorality of their societies resulting from their worship of idols. God says quite plainly that the same fate will befall the Jews should they be seduced into the sin of worshiping idols, and that should a Jewish city be found to be worshiping idols, it too must be destroyed. God is nothing if not even handed, and your guests should know this. All right, here's another listener who says,
We deal with this, by the way, in the book at some length with this particular commandment. So
didn't the Boers think the same? Doesn't China think they have the right to rule their part of the globe? Doesn't every human society think it's superior or chosen? As far as I'm aware, America's unique because it offers inclusion to anyone, in contrast to others, which have closed membership based on genealogy. And Drew says, Mr. Krasny, today you and your guests are talking about Jewish and American exceptionalism in a way that elevates it to a place of respect. Would your guests similarly view German exceptionalism under the Nazis as romantically, or Hutu exceptionalism in Rwanda, or the current members of the American financial class's feeling of exceptionalism? Exceptionalism is a very destructive force, even for America and the Jews. Today, the Jews are subjugating Arabs under the belief they are exceptional. The U.S. exterminated an entire race, Native Americans, under this belief. Your guests should not be elevating exceptionalism because it almost in every case leads to very bad results.
I guess my response is simply to say that fire is dangerous, but it has to be respected. It's there. It's a force, and it can accomplish good things. I don't deny I think extermination of the Native Americans is too strong. Most of the Native Americans died because of disease that was introduced.
That's absolutely
but it was certainly not whitewashing the awful history of the American settlers.
But the Puritans killed the Indians in large part because they were pagans, really.
Well, there was – I mean, it's a complicated story. And, you know, part of it involved, you know, a desire to convert them. They were, it was mystifying to the whites, and you know, who are these people? And great barbarism was committed. There was also a lot of tenderness. There's a kind of romance that we talk about through American religion. The whole Pocahontas romance of intermarriage and so on comes from that. But look, all nations are founded in barbarism. And that's just the human condition. And the problem is to take seriously that this is our history and try to grow up. We can't rescind the history, alas.
Ah, there's a good note to conclude on, especially that alas, which was said with a good sigh. Thank you, Todd Gitlin. Thank you, Leah Leibovitz. Good to have you both with us this
hour. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
The book, again, is The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election. And let me just remind you that Leah Leibovitz is professor at New York University of Communications, and Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology, and chairs the PhD program in communications at Columbia. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or calling our listener call and response line at 415-553-3300. Tomorrow in this hour, Salman Rushdie. I hope you'll join us for that, and thank you for joining us this morning on Forum. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.